Thank you for all your service, Rhode. And I'd thank the Shires and Jerry, except I don't want to give him a big head. Too late. You guys have been wonderful. You know what? You've thought all our stupidity is funny, and I love you for that. I mean, really. I think that step 12 might very well be the most important thing you can do here. You can stay physically sober possibly for a lifetime with step 12. You may not be happy. You may still struggle with depression and anger and a lot of stuff. But when it's in the beginning of chapter 7, it says, "Nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics." I've watched this is the thing that's gotten me through the toughest times in my sobriety. It saved me. And one of the words that it uses on page 100 is persistence. It says, if you persist, you and the new man, if you persist. And you know, I one of the sad things that I observe in the fellowship of AA is that some people take a stab at this, and maybe they quit. I run into people that I ask them, "You sponsor anybody?" "Oh, that's not my niche." "Well, what do you mean?" "Well, I sponsored the Cup 3 people, and they didn't stay sober, so it's not my niche." One of my favorite Will Wilson stories is in December 15th, 1934, Bill Wilson exited Towns Hospital, and he started trying to help drunks because he had a vision, and he was inspired with the idea that maybe he could keep this awakening alive, maybe he could stay sober if he helped other alcoholics. And from December 15th, 1934, to May 10th, 1935, Wilson worked with 96 failures in a little over more than 4 months. 96 failures until he met Dr. Bob. And Bob didn't stay sober the first. Bob had one more relapse coming. So if you've worked with 3 people that didn't stay sober, you got 93 more people to try before you can come to a conclusion that it's not your niche. There's a spiritual principle. You throw enough crap up against the wall, some of it's eventually going to stick. So you're in the, just keep flinging the crap. That's all you got to keep doing is fling. And you make mistakes, and some of you are afraid, "What if I make a mistake? What if I hurt somebody?" Well, I don't think you get good at it till you kill about 3. I mean, you got to... just keep flinging the crap, and it's a work in progress. And you will grow in understanding and effectiveness, and you will learn how to be a good sponsor and a good servant by trying. You will make mistakes. I guarantee you. I've made a bunch. I did. I look back at my first many years of sobriety. I did a lot of frantic 12-step work trying to get free of me, and I didn't have any principles. So when you do that, all you're doing is you're shooting from the hip with ego. And I didn't know what I was doing. And it wasn't when I started to really. I had a guy commit suicide on me, and I loved this man. Him and I were very close. We spent hours and hours in Denny's talking about our lives, and we had so much in common, and he committed suicide. And I remember being, I was at his service, and I knew I loved him, and I knew I couldn't quit to helping people because it was the only relief I was finding for me. I knew that it could keep me sober. I was now sober longer than I'd ever imagined was possible. Yet I also knew that I didn't have what he needed either. And Andy's death pushed me into this book, and especially into the chapter working with others, because I didn't want to ever sit in a church chapel again wondering where I let a guy down. And that's not that we become perfect at this stuff, we don't. But at least I started coming from principle rather than shooting from the hip. I started coming, leading with principles before my own egocentric personality. And oddly enough, the closer I've come to following the do's and don'ts in working with others, it seems like the more effective I am. In this chapter, I'm not going to get into too much of the nuts and bolts, except to encourage you to read it and encourage you to keep flinging crap up against the wall. And it's a work in progress. I think sometimes the stuff it tells us not to do in here is as important as the things it tells us to do. And it tells you pretty much an order of events, how to do them, and quickly. And I try to get people in quick. I don't come from a school where let them go to meetings for a year. Some guys don't have a long fuse, a year fuse. Some guys that's good for them, and other guys, if they don't get into the steps and have some kind of awakening pretty quick, they'll never stay physically sober long enough. And so I sponsor guys and I push them along the steps as quickly as their level of willingness will allow. But I keep nudging them. You'll never hear me say to a sponsee, "Well, you should probably back off of AA a little bit." You're never going to hear that from me. I got one thing: is turn the volume up, keep moving forward. You know, just keep rowing the boat. You know, that's all I know. And what I discovered over the years is that this is the vehicle by which God does and carries out what I ask Him to do in step three when I ask Him to relieve me of the bondage of self. It is through helping others. I got sober. I'd been diagnosed as clinically depressed, and I was I battled depression a lot in my early sobriety. And the only freedom I would get from it is I'd get these little islands where I'm on a 12-step call, or I'm spending some time with some guy after a meeting at the detox talking to him, and he's telling me about his problems, and I'm free of my problems. And I started to realize that the same thing that Wilson realized, you know, in his story, him and I are very much alike. And my sponsor's this way, too. My sponsor is by nature a depressive alcoholic. Left alone, guys like Wilson, guys like me, guys like Clancy will just sit and we'll ponder ourselves into oblivion. I mean, we're just that way. And so Wilson discovered at times that he would be slipping back into resentment and self-pity, and he said that it was so brutal at times that it was in danger of driving him back to drink. And then he said he learned something. He said he learned if he went back to his old hospital, Towns Hospital, and he'd go up to Silky, the doctor there, and say, "Do you got a guy I can talk to?" And Silkworth would steer him into some bed, some guy who's coming apart at the seams, and he said he'd spend a couple hours with this pure wretch that's throwing his guts up, coming apart at the seams. He said he would be miraculously uplifted and set on his feet. He said it was a design for living that worked when under tough going. And it really is. And I'll tell you, not only will it free you from you and keep you sober, but in it, God will protect you and save you. This sounds weird, and I know God loves us all, and I really, really know that. But God seems to take especially good care of His servants. And maybe it's not that it takes especially good care of His servants. Maybe it's just that the servants are positioning themselves to more easily catch the grace that's all of our inheritance. But I know that the people in Alcoholics Anonymous that are the servants seem to survive here. I heard a trustee at my first area service conference, probably 1979, say this trustee was given a talk and said something I never forgot. Might have been 1980, 79 or 80. He said that he believed that 5% of the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous did 95% of the service in 12-step work. And then he said that 5%, as long as they remained a 5%er and continued to do that, never drank again. And so I want to be a 5%er and stay a 5%er. I don't want to be I hope I'm never the old timer when presented with an opportunity to serve or help a drunk or that I say, I hope you never hear me say, God forbid, I hope you never hear me say, oh, let a newer guy do that. I've done enough of that already. I hope you never hear me say that. Because what I would really be saying is that I've outgrown this. I'm superior now. I hope you never hear me say that. And I'll keep my feet in action. And I'll tell you a little story. And then when I was, if I can do nothing else this weekend except encourage some of you who don't do 12-step work and don't sponsor to turn up the volume in those actions, I think I might have done something nice this weekend. I hope I can do that. Because God will work through the people that you think you're trying to help you. It's a funny dynamic, but it's the helper that gets the help. When I was new, I didn't fit in AA, and that's not unusual. You know, I go to meetings, it seems like everybody knows everybody forever, and they're all best friends, and then there's me, you know, and I'm the guy who, you know, sits in the back of the room and just wonders why nobody likes me, and I just sit and think things at you, you know, and some brilliant old timer came up to me one time and he said, I need your help with something. I said, yeah, what? I was just glad somebody's talking to me. I said, yeah, what? He said, well, we need some. You're pretty new, aren't you? And I said, yeah, I'm just a week out of the hospital. He said, well, good. He said, we need someone who's really new, who the memory of the difficulty of getting sober and coming to AA is fresh within them to go and greet the new people and let them know that there's somebody here that knows what it feels like to be new and you can try to make them feel welcome. I thought, well, I could do that. I don't have any profundity. I don't know about the steps. I don't know none of that. But I know what it's like to be awkward here. I know what it's like to get sober. I know I can share that with people. And I started trying to make, I was a greeter. I started talking to the newer people and the breaks and going up and talk to them and after the meeting, trying to make them feel welcome. I got to tell you something. I have no idea if I ever made one of those people feel like they were part of AA except me. As a result of those actions, I started to claim my place in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a funny dynamic that you will get what you give here. You will not get what you take. You will get what you give. When I was in my 11th year of sobriety, I went through possibly one of the two toughest, yeah, I'd say probably the two toughest times in the last 36 years. Man, there's been a few, but these are the two. This one of the two toughest. And what had happened is I was married. I'd been in a relationship for over 6 years. I was married to a gal. We were married 4.5 years. I had a daughter that was almost just about 2 years old who I just adored. I mean, I was in the delivery room with her. We were supposed to do Lamaze, and until the first contraction hit. I didn't know you could yell morphine that loud in a hospital. but I was the first human being to ever hold my daughter in my arms. She cried her first tears in my arms. I cut her umbilical cord, cleaned her up, gave her first bath. It stole my heart. Well, here we are, my daughter's almost 2 years old, and I ended up going through a very difficult divorce. And it was actually, the divorce wasn't as bad. It was the day after the divorce that I find out why we're getting a divorce. I didn't really understood it, except that we'd grown apart somehow, but I didn't understand what was really going on. And the day after the divorce, when my wife and daughter moved in with one of my sponsees and best friends, and I find out they'd been sleeping together the last year of my marriage, all of a sudden I understood what was going on, or a big piece of it anyway. And now that's a whole nother story involving the resentment process in the book, how I got free of that. But here's the problem. I love my daughter, and I have legal rights to see her. The problem is, to go spend time with her, I have to go to where they're all living together in order to pick her up. But some of you may understand this, I don't know. I had heartache for my daughter. I yearned, I missed her so badly. And I was willing to walk through the fear and the difficulty to go and pick her up over there. So I made an appointment, and I went over there in the morning, late morning, to pick her up. And we're going to spend the whole day together. And I went over. I remember driving up to where they're living together, and I had this knot in the pit of my stomach. And I parked out front, and I walked up to the door, and I rang the doorbell, and the frickin' happy couple answers the door. They call Kate, and Kate comes running out, cutest little thing you ever seen, a little dress, about 2 years old, just adorable. I take her by the hand, we go off for the day, we have a whole day planned together, it's going to be very cool. First of all, we went to Chuck E. Cheese for lunch. I don't know if you have Chuck E. Cheese down here, it's a very bizarre place. For about $80, you can win a 10-cent ring. It's really, my daughter used to love trying to push those balls up into those holes, and oh, geez. They got a 6-foot rat that walks around and says hi to everybody. And my friend Steve Lee detoxed in a Chuck E. Cheese. He said, that's a bad place to be detoxing. Yeah. Right. Yeah, I love it when he told that story, because I've been in Chuck E. Cheese. And so we were there for a while. And then I took her and we went to visit a ranch that was owned by the people who had the Legends in Concert show at the Imperial Palace. It was a big ranch, lots of ponies, horses, sheep, goats, rabbits, cows. I mean, it was a full deal ranch. And my daughter loved animals, and we were going to go there and play with the animals. And one of the things, the highlights for her and for us, was that she was going to get to ride some of these little Shetland ponies. And she was very excited about the whole concept of ponies. She just loved the idea of riding ponies. So we went there and we played with a lot of the animals and stuff, and she had a great time. She got to feed them, and it was just very cool for her. To this day, she loves animals. And she got to ride the ponies around the corral, and it was a little scary for her. Even though these were just little ponies, it was a little scary because she's just a little girl. And so we had to kind of go with her and make sure she didn't fall off, et cetera. And we were done riding the ponies around the corral. And we're next to the corral, there's a picnic table. So we're sitting there, and the woman, who's my friend who's involved in the ranch, is sitting there, and Kate and I are sitting there. And Katie is thirsty. So back across the yard, next to the stables, is a soda machine. So I said to the gal, I said, just hang out with Kate for a few minutes. I'm going to go get some cans of soda. So I walked across the yard, went to the soda machine. I got some cans of soda. I'm coming back across, and as I'm getting close to the picnic table, I hear the woman say to my daughter, hey, Kate, here comes your daddy. And Kate looks at me, looks at the woman, says, that's not my daddy. Craig's my daddy. And I'll tell you something, it felt like somebody gut shot me, man. And I didn't say nothing. We learned that thing on that streets, how to push that stuff. You know, we learned that. Harden up, push that stuff. I did that. I pushed those feelings down, suppressed them, and put a smile on my face and hung out with the rest of the day. It came supper time. I was supposed to take her home for supper, and I drove her over to where they were living together, and I pulled up out front, and I took her by the hand and walked her up to the door and rang the doorbell, and the happy couple answers the door, and she jumps into his arms, and they say goodbye to me. And I walk back to my car, and I get in my car, and I drive about a block away, and I pull over to the side of the road, and I just come apart. And I'm sitting in the car, and I'm I'm almost schizophrenic. I'm crying and talking to God at the same time. And I'm saying to God, as I'm sobbing, I'm saying, I love my daughter, but I can't see her anymore. This hurts too much. I'm not big enough for this. And I'd made the decision to just, I couldn't do this. I can't handle it. I'm not going to see my daughter anymore. And as I'm sitting there, I look at the clock on the dashboard, and I'd remembered that I told this idiot newcomer that I'd pick him up at the SOS club and take him across town to a step study. And I don't want to go meet this new guy. I want to go home and think. You know, I want to go home and ponder this whole situation. But you guys have brainwashed me to show up where you say you're going to show up and do what you say you're going to do. And, well, I might be late, so now I'm rushing over to the SOS club to pick up this knucklehead, and I pull up out front. He's standing out front. I get in the car. We head across town to go to this step study. And I don't even think he's in the car but a minute or two, and he starts to break down and cry as he tells me that he just had found out once again by the courts that he'd been denied the ability to see his kids again. And I'm looking at him and his pain and heartache of not even being able to see his kids. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, Bob, there's only one person that could stop you from seeing your daughter, and that's you. And I remember looking at him and thinking to myself, oh, I'll see her again next week. I can do this 1 week at a time. And 1 week at a time, and it's been, she just turned, last month she turned 27. We've been all over the world together. He came and went in that thing and went on to another marriage after that, and I'm her dad. You know, I'm her dad, and she's the most important single individual in my life. And that guy saved me. God worked through that guy to save Bob from Bob. Because I stood on the precipice of a very, very bad decision. And he saved me from that decision. And the new people, they think you're helping them. Oh, not really. They're freeing you. Wilson knew that. The early members knew it. Sometimes we forget it today. I go to groups and I know old timers that don't help anybody anymore. Their life has all become all about themselves. Their primary purpose has shifted from helping others to helping themselves. And you can see it and feel it in their demeanor. And they're stagnant. Up in Northern California, in Monterey, there's a section right on Monterey where there's a couple canneries, and there's this one old cannery. It's been there for a long time. And there's a type of pelican that lives in Monterey Bay. And these pelicans are some of God's greatest fishermen. They can be flying and see a fish and catch that fish, dive under that water, get that fish. They're really very good at it. Well, this cannery that opened on the docks many, many years ago, they started as they would clean the fish and process them. They would take the fish guts and they would pile them on the dock. And it was like this big gurry bin, sort of, you know, the piled up fish guts, basically. And what happened is that it attracted all these pelicans. And the pelicans would come over and they would eat the fish guts because it was like a free meal, right? Well, after several generations of pelicans, they're pretty much sustaining themselves by eating all the fish guts, right? Well, one day a vitamin company comes through and they make a deal with the cannery to buy all the fish guts in order to process omega oils for capsules to sell in the vitamin stores. And all of a sudden, one day, there's no more fish guts on the pier. And the pelicans are flying around and gathering around there waiting, and there's no fish guts. And the problem is now for several generations, they have forgotten how to fish. And they're starving to death and they're dying. So environmentalists came along and they realized what was going on. So what they had to go and do was they went and they got little small adolescent, almost baby pelicans from other areas, and they brought them there. And the new pelicans taught the old pelicans what the old pelicans had forgotten on how to fish, right? And sometimes the new guys I work with, as I'm trying to help them and encourage them to do 12-step calls, they re-teach me how to fish. Because you forget. You forget. The alcoholic always remembers what he should forget and forgets what he should remember. We forget. And I am renewed by the people that I try to help. And they keep me alive, and they keep me diligent and enthusiastic, and they keep me in the middle of AA because they watch you. And they watch what you do. They see what you do. And our actions will speak louder than our words. So I can't encourage people enough to do this, to do it. You know, there's a great... We get sober, most of us, with a horrid, horrid loneliness in us. And there's a promise in the book, and the book says that God will show us how to create the fellowship we crave. And he does. And he does by our 12-step work, by giving, abandoning ourselves to another purpose, a purpose greater than ourselves. And I often wondered, how do you get right with yourself when you secretly don't like yourself and you're full of remorse and shame and you have no self-esteem? And how do you even increase that at all? How do you ever get right with the memories of the horrid things you did that hurt people? And the shame that's attached to that. You know how you get right with it? You make it useful. I found myself over the years in sponsoring guys pulling stuff out of my closet that I was so ashamed of and so embarrassed about at one time, and it becomes very useful. It'll change someone else's life. Because inherent in the spiritual sickness of alcoholism is a feeling of separation and loneliness. You're dying of, you feels like you're dying of guilt and remorse, but you're really dying of separation, because your ego is beating you up with the same judgment you've beat the world up, and now it's kept you separate and apart from. And the first thing we do that's glorious for each other is we let each other know we're not alone. You see, I did what you did. I felt what you felt. I experience, I know, you're not unique. And out of that comes we come into reality and find the courage to mend these things and take care of some of this stuff and work through these steps. It's a beautiful thing. And I can't encourage you enough to start pitching. Don't worry about making mistakes. You will. You will. I guarantee it. And 10 years from now, you'll be using those mistakes as ways to help other new guys not to make the mistake. You can't help them unless you make the mistakes that you can help them with. And that's how we help each other here. I am more useful because of my failures and stupidity than I ever am for my successes. Matter of fact, go to your home group. Tell them you just lost everything and you're going through a divorce. You will never feel closer to those people. Go to your home group and tell them you just got $1 million a year bonus and see how many potlucks you're invited to. They'll resent you for that. It's fun. We're a funny fellowship. We get closer to each other by our mistakes and the things we do wrong than we ever do by the things we do right. And so, page 100, and I'll read this and turn it over to Mari. Both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. They really will. That's, we talk about remarkable stuff in AA. We take it for granted. We get a little jaundiced about it, a little calloused. How many times, you probably had those experiences. Somebody say, oh, remember Joe used to live in the bushes? He bought his first house today. Yeah, yeah, where's the coffee? You know, it's like we get, you get kind of jaunt. The guy that was in the mental health system for 10 years, so medicated, he came here as a zombie, and now he's sponsoring people and laughing. He doesn't take any meds anymore, and he has a freedom that was beyond anything humanly possible. And we go, oh, yeah, of course. You take it for granted. That stuff happens here all the time. Remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us, we didn't manufacture them, we didn't manipulate them, the things that came to us as a free gift, an unmerited gift from God. When we put ourselves in God's hands, we're better than anything we could have planned. Really and truly, God's vision of Bob's life is much better than Bob's vision of God's life, of Bob's life. Follow the dictates of a higher power and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world no matter what your present circumstances, no matter what. It doesn't matter that you're in a halfway house and you can't ever imagine having your own apartment because you can't think you can get first and last month's rent. It doesn't matter that you're on paper and you don't think you'll ever get a good job because you're a felon. It doesn't matter that you're so emotionally messed up that you'll never be okay. It doesn't matter where you came from. It doesn't matter that you were abused as a child. It doesn't matter that you secretly stabbed someone and killed them and nobody knows about it. It doesn't matter what your present circumstances are. Come here, open yourself up, take this process, devote your life to helping others. Live in God's world, and I'll tell you, amazing things will happen. It doesn't matter. It's all, no matter how bad you are when you come in here, it's all in time. Just you look back and you go, it was just a bunch of excuses. It was just a bunch of excuses. Mari.
Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Spiritual awakening is defined on page 567 of the big book. It said it shows that the past personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms. And you know, part of this great change of personality that we have had is that I'm able to do, see, feel, and believe things I could not do, see, feel, and believe in my own unaided will. What has happened to me is I have had a change of perception through working through the steps. I've had a change of personality. I now see the world differently. Bill Wilson said that our past is our most treasured possession. With it, we can avert death and misery for people. My horrible past that I thought nobody would ever want to know about, I regret none of it because it has been enabled me to help people who thought that nobody had ever been where they had been and seen what I had seen. That is because somebody came to me who had been that place and was able to share with me. You know, on page 15, Bill says, things sometimes nearly drove him to drink, but he found that when all other measures failed, work with another alcoholic would save the day. He said it was a design for living that really works. A few years ago, I was speaking in Hawaii, and the conference was called A Design for Living. And they had given us all badges with Design for Living and our name. And I was on the elevator with about, I don't know how many, however much the elevator could hold, it was full of alcoholics except for a man and his daughter. And he sees all these badges and he turns to me, he said, are you all interior decorators?
That's good.
I said, after a fashion.
Yeah.
Because it's an inside job. You know, it is an inside job. And, you know, I have found that this 12-step, it has just, working with others has given me such a raison d'etre. Why did I speak French there? I must be thinking of the Chinese woman, but... It's got me on a fork. Maybe I'm going to have to make an amend in French, but it's given me a reason for being, a reason for living. You know, I am so delighted that at age 71, I still have strength. I still have a reason for being. I still have a life of meaning and purpose. You know, there's other people my age that don't do these things. Because what working with others does is it gives you a great energy. And, it is the antidote to selfish, self-centered alcoholics like me who almost disappeared into their own navel thinking about things. You see, most psychologies in the world, because Dr. Silkworth talks in the big book about some moral psychology he thought alcoholics needed. But most psychologists in the world have you get inside yourself. You know, they want you to get inside and find out what's really going on. Alcoholics Anonymous is about getting out of yourself. It is an amazing thing. It is so multifaceted for people like me who have had so many problems. They seemed insurmountable. And it was people working with me. You know, one of the things they told me, because they gave me a reality check, one of the reasons I had had a slip was the agony. You heard Bob talk about it. My children lived in Jamaica. I lived in Alberta. I couldn't get to see them for a while. I knew they'd never, I wasn't sober. And then I had 4 months sobriety. And I'm not going to get into what happened when I brought them up to Canada, which I shouldn't have done, because the old timer said to me, my aunts came and chaperoned them. And then they went back to Scotland a day before my sons went back, and I drank. I mean, the things I did. My sponsor had said to me, "Don't have your children come. You're not ready." And I didn't listen to her. And one more time, I created despair for my kids. And then the old timer said to me, "Let's give you a reality check. You might never get your family back. You might never get them back." And you know, he said, "You might never get your boys back." And I never did get my little boys back. My boys were taken away when they were 11 and 7. And I got them back 13 years later. 13 years. I will tell you that the agony of it sometimes comes back to me today. Sometimes I would be walking along and I'll think of something I did to my children, and just for a moment, the agony of it is almost beyond endurance. And rather than ponder it and think about it, I try and get into gratitude that they're in my life today. But I will tell you that my heart is cracked. And if God took me off the street and saved me for anything, it is so that I am able to say to some women that please don't lose your children. That this is a killer of children's lives, this alcoholism. A killer of their lives. And you know, I'll tell you, I've been sober a long time now. But how this affects our children is very, very deep. My children love me very much. But a few years ago, I was sitting down. My son had sent me a first-class ticket for Aruba. And he's the youngest one and the one that never wants to talk about the alcoholism and what it did to him. I don't want to talk about it. Mom, I love you more than anything. I don't want to talk about it. Whereas my eldest son has spoken about it. He had verbal diarrhea for years. I mean, it was really, he talked it out. He talked it out. So I'm there visiting my son. And it's getting dark outside. And my little grandkids at that time were 4 and 7. No, my son I'm staying with was 7 when he was taken away. I said to him, "Mark, don't you think you should bring the children in? It's getting dark outside." And without turning around or missing a beat, he said to me, "So where was I when I was 7, Mom?" And it was like a knife to my stomach. But he was right. How can I tell him how to bring up his children? When look what he's 7 when he's taken away. I wasn't there to kiss away his boo-boos. I wasn't there to read him stories. I wasn't there to cheer him on when he had triumphs. He didn't know what had happened, only that his mommy was gone. So I am able to share these things with people. And working with others, you know what it's like? It's like in the spiritual life, we never get to see the big picture why something is happening. We get to see it afterwards. And we realize that's why that was like that, and this is like that, and that is like that. And that is what I saw when I read that thing about our past is our most treasured possession. With it, we can avert death and misery for people. I thought, wow, this is almost like alchemy. This is alchemy. You know, Bill Wilson had said once, Alcoholics Anonymous is not a success story. Rather, it is a dialogue of our chronic human failure turned to usefulness by the divine alchemy of a loving God. The old alchemists long ago, they were trying to convert the lead of the soul into shining spirit. People thought they were trying to convert lead into gold, but they weren't. They were trying to convert the dark spirit into the light spirit. And that is what we do here. It's like alchemy. It's like we're a bunch of alchemists working with each other. You can see the conversion. Some of the women I sponsor, I am in awe of their courage and strength. I'll give you 2 examples of people, young women. I sponsor a woman who's 8 years sober. And she's never had access to her kids since she got into AA, 8 years. And she doesn't mind if I tell this story. But she does what I tell her all the time. She sends them money and sends them cards for the birthdays and for the Christmas, and she never hears back from them. Her youngest was 15. 2 years ago, the police come to her door. Your 15-year-old son just hung himself. He left a note saying, I love you all. And she hadn't. The ex-husband didn't even call her. He sent the police. What does she do? She, with great dignity, go to the funeral where she's ostracized by the family, completely and utterly ostracized by her other children. And she goes there with her husband in dignity. And that poor little boy is lying there in the coffin, 15 years old. Another woman asked her daughter to drop her to work last year. Beautiful girl, 21. And she drops her mom off and had just left her and hit a patch of black ice and was sandwiched with 2 cars and died instantly. And these are very active women in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am in awe of what they can do. And what they did was they worked with others. That's the solution to this thing, is working with others. And we see it. You know, like Bob, one of my diagnoses, the last diagnosis I got for the court from the psychiatrist, it's the last one I've ever had. And it said, chronic alcoholic, abnormal personality, and depressive. And it went on to say, this woman suffers from a sense of profound inner emptiness. Profound inner emptiness. And I used to fill that inner emptiness up with spirit. And that inner emptiness is now filled up with the spiritual life of helping others. Forgetting about me. That it's not all about me anymore. And like Bob, I am very active in my group. And sometimes people will come and say, let's leave stuff for the younger people. Let's get them active. We won't take these positions. But I want to have a position at my group. So even if they don't elect me, I'm greeting. You know? I want to do something. You know, on page 100, in the paragraph there, he says, when we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Look at our lives today. Is it not better than anything you could ever have planned? For me, it's certainly not what I thought it was going to be. But it is the best life ever. And I'll tell you, you guys are funnier than the guys in the mental institution. You too, John.
I'm crazier.
Yeah. You know, this life, it's a wonderful, wonderful life. And, you know, it says our problems were of our own making. The bottle was only a symbol. By the time we come through these steps the first time, we realize what Bill Wilson said. There is a lot wrong with us about which a lot has to be fixed. And a lot of times I realize what is going on with me by talking to a sponsee or by working with others. You know, a very sad thing happened in our group, and I'll share it with you. I'll tell you about him first then. Yeah, there was a fellow in our group, and he just couldn't fit in. He tried so hard. He was a young guy. He did everything to fit in. He was busy. He was active. He got 2 years sobriety, and then he jumped off the bridge. 26. He wasn't an alcoholic. He was not an alcoholic. He was a drug addict. And he'd been sent to AA. And he could not identify. He didn't like alcohol. It never did anything for him. He never drank alcohol. And here we are. And I thought to myself, I should have... He never wanted to share his story, but he wanted to be very active in service. Why didn't I go and talk to him more? Why didn't I pay more attention to him? Because he looked okay on the outside. But then I realized too, he liked the guys in the group. He liked the people in the group. But he was coming in there and feeling that he didn't belong. That he wasn't a part of. And it alienated him. And I remember at his funeral, his mother was coming to thank us all because we'd kept him sober for 2 years. I don't know, maybe that boy, you know, for some of us, when the pain of being sober is greater than the pain of being drunk, we will die. We'll just leave AA. But I wonder sometimes if I should be paying more attention. And I try to do that. And it's difficult. You know, outer appearances are not in a reality. You know, and that is why the one thing I do with newcomers, even fellows, is I always say, do you have a sponsor? Are you keeping in contact? I have learned to sponsor over the years. I've had wonderful sponsors. I've gone back to Clancy because my sponsor, Norma, died. She died in May, and she'd been my sponsor for 18 years, and I really missed her. But I believe in strong sponsorship, and I've gone back to Clancy. And I've had good sponsorship all the way along. But, you know, in the early days, I really wanted to sponsor, but I wanted to have a regiment of sponsees. I had visions of them lining up and two-stepping an army march and inside, sitting in the front row, you know. And then somebody said to me, you're a Nazi sponsor. This is all about you. It's not about them. And then I found out that they were having, I wasn't even 5 years sober. They were comparing notes on who'd been fired the most by me. because I'd fire them and take them back and fire them and take them back. And I'm sitting in a meeting one day, and one gal stood up and said, "I've been fired 4 times by Mary." And everybody laughed. And I thought, that is so disgusting. I wasn't even 5 years sober. I thought I was helping. It wasn't all about me. So I had to learn very, very gradually how to sponsor properly. And it takes a lot of work. And we have a lot of great examples. I love how Clancy sponsors. And he sponsors by structure. And I needed structure in my life. Structure has sometimes kept me from going a little over the edge when I'm feeling a little crazy sometimes. Structure has kept me from going over when I'm feeling a little depressed sometimes. Working with others, if I ever feel I'm getting into me, I pick up the phone. I tell my sponsees to pick up the phone. I say, look, I want you to contact 3 alcoholics a day. I want you to pick up. I sponsor women who are suffering terrible illnesses, chronic illnesses. And I see the courage in them. And you know, I told you I used to go into the maximum penitentiaries. And I also used to go downtown to the Sally Ann. And I used to go down to all where the street people were. And I used to look at them, and some of them don't want to hear an AA talk. And some of them are beyond repair. But I'll tell you something, every time I go down there and see them and put my hand out, whether they want it or not, I never move my hand away because they're dirty or filthy. I always look them in the eye. I hug them. I let them know that there is a solution, that I've been where they've been. I ask them to come into the meeting. Some of them come in and sit and shout. Some of them come in and sit and scratch. Some of them come in and they just want a little place for a little rest for a little while. But I used to do that because I believe that we've all had these different experiences for a reason. And there's some people that I will be able to touch that you won't touch. And there's some people I won't be able to touch that you will touch. And that is why this is such a wonderful organization, because we all have our own stories. Essentially, they're about recovery from alcoholism. But you know, there's what you have to have with a sponsor is rapport. If you don't have rapport, you won't have anything. And in working with others, in the very early days, we used to do a lot of 12-stepping. But we always used to go in twos. And I went on some hairy 12-step calls, I'll tell you, and heard guns going off. And one time I went alone. I didn't follow instructions. And this gal was crazy. And we stop and she pulls out a carpet cutter on me. And because I've lived my life on high alert, you know, no, we don't get those things anymore. The 12-step, you cannot transmit what you don't have. And that is why it's so important. I found from my own mistakes and errors that I cannot transmit what I don't have. I cannot transmit what this is all about if I haven't practiced it. Because, you know, you can't con a con. Alcoholics have to have something, the message has to have depth and meaning. We can be funny, but the message has to have depth and meaning. You can't pretend to an alcoholic because they know. Because we are talking about things that come from deep experience. So I would say to you, never pretend to an alcoholic. Always give them honesty. And you know, as I said, you know, a lot of it is humiliation at great depth sometimes when a sponsee asks me something. And I don't want to say to them, you know what, I really don't know. Let me get back to you. But I've learned how to do that, and it gives me a little more humility. It says here, if he is to find God, the desire must come from within. And as I said the other day, there is no spiritual Viagra. The desire comes from pain and grief and suffering. And Alcoholics Anonymous is for people that want it, not for people that need it. So I want to say that I am so delighted to have been here with you all this weekend. I want to thank Jerry, Maggie. I want to thank you all for putting this on. I don't know. And being with Bob. I love being with Bob. I just admire and respect him so very much. So thank you for having me here.
We close with the Lord's Prayer. We hook up and close with the Lord's Prayer.